rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Glad to have you back. Beautiful Tuesday to you. What a marvelous day here. A gray, cloudy, but it's getting warm. Spring is coming. We only have 2.5 feet of snow on the ground right now here in the People's Republic of Vermont. We're discovering today in the Wall Street Journal that they told us what Condi's trip is really all about. I was wondering, okay, she's going to India, she's going to Pakistan. It's being spun in the media as our Secretary of State is doing goodwill trips. But this administration has been pretty upfront right from the very beginning, 5 years ago, that their agenda was the agenda of big multinational corporations. In fact, you know, George W. referred to him as the first CEO president, and Dick Cheney is the first CEO vice president, that they were going to reorganize business, reorganize the executive branch of the government along the lines of a business. In other words, everything benefits the bottom line. There's a single value system, and the bottom line, of course, in their case, rather than being profit like it is in a corporation, is power and perpetuating their own power. Sort of the same philosophy Vladimir Putin has, you know, if you want to get right down to it. So anyhow, here in today's Wall Street Journalist article by Carla Ann Robbins and Greg Jaffe, U.S. may sell F-16s to India and Pakistan. Yep, that's what this trip is all about. Condi is going as a salesperson. Now, this is nothing new. This was done under the Clinton administration. It was done under the Bush administration before that. It was done under the Reagan administration. You could argue it goes back to maybe Truman, certainly the Eisenhower administration, that one of the jobs of government, in fact, you could argue that it goes back even before that. I believe, I may be wrong, somebody, you know, correct me, somebody in the chat room, let me know if I'm wrong on this. The old statement, you know, what's good for General Motors is good for America, was from, well, I could be wrong. My recollection is it was from our Secretary of State in during the Roosevelt administration, but probably Eisenhower. Anyhow, somebody I'm sure will track that down and let me know. By the way, if you'd like to drop into our chat room, TomHartman.com, click on live chat. Our telephone number, 1-866, toll-free, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. So here we have this headline, U.S. may sell F-16s to India and Pakistan. Then the subhead, policy shift would signal tacit acceptance of rivals' possession of nuclear arms. Now, you don't think Iran is looking at that going, oh, okay, once you tell America that you have the bomb, you can be, and you can have a military dictatorship where you overthrow a democratically elected government, as Musharraf did in Pakistan, and you torture people, and you harbor terrorists, and that's just fine with the United States. They'll sell you F-16s. You just have to get the bomb first. Seems like it might work. They note the Wall Street Journal, this could draw charges of a double standard from European countries because the U.S. has been criticizing the European Union's plan to lift its arms embargo to China. You know, the EU, they say, well, you know, we'd like to sell to China. Yeah, they're dictators, but, you know, they're not so bad. You guys are giving them hundreds of billions of dollars a year in your debt. I mean, you're borrowing all this money from them. You're turning them into your major manufacturing sector. Most of the stuff that people buy in the United States is not made by Americans anymore. It's made by Chinese. How can you criticize us for wanting to do business with them, too? Even if it's weapons. You guys are doing business with them with weapons, more or less, by helping them build their infrastructure. And then we get into the Tom DeLay portion of this. The jets for Pakistan would be built at the Lockheed Martin, Texas plant. And Lockheed Martin has been pushing Washington hard on these sales. They say that they've told the United States that unless they receive new orders by October for the F-16, they're going to begin shutting down their production plants late this year. That's not going to help the Republicans in Texas at all. And here's where it gets really weird. This is the, here's your Lou Dobbs moment. This is the, you know, the only guy in national television who's talking about these issues. A Republican of all things. Here's where it gets really weird. The jets for Pakistan will be built at Lockheed Martin's Texas plant. If the Indian deal goes forward, however, the first dozen would be built in the U.S. And then production would shift to India. You get that? I mean, talk about selling the short-term benefit for long-term gain. Giving away the store in exchange for a week's worth of food. I mean, this is... Lockheed Martin is saying to the administration, we're going to start shutting down our plants in Texas, and no doubt saying it to Tom DeLay, and Tom DeLay is saying it to Condi Rice, and he's here's the hoop jump, and she's jumping. We're going to shut down our plants, our F-16 assembly plants in Texas, and lay off Texans, you know, Texas workers, harm the Texas economy if you don't get a deal for us to sell these F-16s to India. And by the way, if you do get a deal for us to sell them to India, after we make the first dozen of them here in the United States, which is good for about 3 years, that'll take us through the next presidential election. So, you know, certainly through the next congressional cycle. But two more elections. We'll keep Tom DeLay in power for a while. Then we're going to build a factory in India and we're going to start making them there. Now, I would be willing to bet. I don't have Bill Bennett's addiction. I'm not a betting junkie, but if I were, I would be willing to bet that this part of this story, which in my opinion is what they call in journalism the buried lead, this should be the lead of the story, that Lockheed is planning to move their F-16 production to India. That this does not get reported by the corporate media in the United States. It's just amazing. There are so many of these stories that the only place you see them is the Wall Street Journal or Forbes or Fortune. You know, where the elite, the business elite of America, is talking to the business elite of America, and they're just assuming the rest of us aren't paying attention. And by and large, they're right, by the way. But they just lay it out right up front. Although, you know, as I said, I think that the spin on this or the take on this or the lead here has been buried. The jets for Pakistan would be built at Lockheed Martin's Texas plant if the Indian deal goes forward. The first dozen jets would be built in the U.S. and then production would shift to India. And then they go on, as I said before. Well, Lockheed Martin has been pushing Washington hard on boat sales. Lockheed officials have told the U.S. that unless it receives new orders by October for the F-16, it will begin shutting down its production line late this year. Just in time to harm congressional Republicans from Texas. So Condi gets on a plane and off she goes to Pakistan and India to say, you guys want F-16s? We've got F-16s. Aren't you just so excited? Just remarkable. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Tom in St. Paul says he's got something here on germane to what I was just talking about. What is it, Tom? What's up?
Right. On your quote that's often misquoted, that what's good for GM is good for the country.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm looking here at the real source here, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of Quotations. And it says here, a little explanation, for years I thought that was good for our country was good for General Motors and vice versa. That was Charles Wilson.
Charles E. Wilson.
Yeah, in a testimony before the U.S. Senate. And then it says, Wilson, the former president of GM, said this in his confirmation hearings for Secretary of Defense. It is often misquoted as what's good for GM is good for the country.
Oh, interesting. But the actual quote is what's good for the country is good for GM?
The actual quote is this. For years, I thought what was good for our country was good for General Motors and vice versa. That's what he said. And here's another one.
What year was that, by the way?
It doesn't have the year.
I have no recollection when Charles Wilson was head of GM. I mean, it's certainly before the time that I was paying any attention to it. So
here's one here by Calvin Coolidge. It's often misquoted as the business of America is business.
Right.
And actually, he said the chief business of the American people is business.
Yeah.
Which is different, right?
Well, slightly, yeah. It is quite different. Tom, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Good
hey,
to hear
one other
it.
Thing.
Yes, sir.
This thing on with Pakistan and overthrowing a democracy. You see, the Republicans, when they use the word freedom and democracy, they're not thinking justice and fairness and self-determination. They're thinking crony capitalism, man.
Yeah, absolutely. They've totally conflated capitalism and quote freedom.
But when they use that word democracy, we liberals think they're thinking what we're thinking.
Yeah, well, they don't use the word democracy very
right.
often. It's they're Tom, thanks for the call. They're using it in the old Ayn Rand sense, which is that it's that if you have the freedom of the marketplace, if you have the ability to buy and sell things, then you are free. And I would say, number one, from the founding of this country to today, by and large, the people and the politicians that we have elected have agreed with Franklin Roosevelt's comment that a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, if you can't feed your family, if you can't find a job, or if the job you have doesn't pay enough that you can literally feed your family and have a decent standard of living, you're not free. So there is an economic component to freedom. But it's not the Ayn Rand libertarian pseudo-Republican component of, well, it's just the free market. No, it's a matter of defining the rules of the game. That's why we had the minimum wage law in the very first place in 1936 when it was set at 25 cents an hour, which was you could actually live on. It wasn't a lot, but you could actually live on it, I mean, you know, back then. So number one. That being the definition of freedom. And number two, as you said, Tom, they don't talk so much about democracy. Speaking of which, I speak about conservative economics from time to time. Mike sent me an email. He says, yesterday you touched on Walmart's old slogan from the early 80s, late 80s, early 90s. Back then it was bring it home to the USA. Of course, today's slogan is always low price. He says, also, you commonly refer to conservative economics. This is a misnomer that puzzles me. To tie in economic policies as conservative on the right is wrong. They are only conservative on some social issues, but far from conservative on fiscal economic issues. Well, my point, Mike, is that you are literally correct. But in fact, he says, classically, this is liberal economic policies, what the conservatives are promoting. But you have to recognize the brand. If somebody is selling toxic waste as hair conditioner, which is being done, by the way, in the United States. That's a whole other thing. You don't refer to it as toxic waste if you want people to understand you're talking about hair conditioner. I want people to understand that I'm talking about the economic policies that are being promoted by conservatives in this country. And so I refer to it as conservative economics. We all know that by the definition of any textbook, it's not. But that's what they call it. That's what I'll call it. And that way people can understand it. Let's keep things simple here. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Little village baby, they're large enough to be a town. From a little village baby, they're large enough to be a town.
24 and a half minutes past the hour, Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Mike also sent me an email in his previous email where he's talking about liberals and conservatives and all that sort of thing. He says, don't forget Congress has a toll-free number. And here, now, we mentioned this yesterday on the air. Somebody called in with it. I had an interesting experience with this morning. We have two telephone systems here in this building. One is called a Gentner system, which is the one that I use to put people on the air. And then there's another telephone system, and there are some of the lines that overlap with each other. And if I am talking to somebody on the Gentner and somebody else somewhere else in the building picks up any other non-Gentner phone, the Gentner drops the line. So it automatically senses when the phone has been picked up on this end. If somebody on the other end, you know, picks up another extension, if I'm talking to somebody in California and somebody else picks up, the Gentner doesn't care. but it's designed to drop somebody off the air if the phone line is being otherwise used. And I called this 800 number for the Congress 6 times this morning, and every single time, as soon as they answered, the Gettner dropped them, which I thought was really weird. It's like as soon as they answer in Washington D.C., somehow my phone system here is sensing that somebody in Montpelier here in Vermont has picked up another line. So go figure. I don't know. But anyhow, finally it worked. And Mike pointed out, there may be a story with this toll-free number that I don't know about. In fact, when I called the regular 202 number and asked if there was a toll-free number for Congress, they said no. But here is a toll-free number that looks like it gets you through to Congress. It's 1-877-762-8762. And I did call it, and I asked for Bernie Sanders' office, and they put me right through. And I got his office. Now, here's the interesting thing. Mike says the acronym for this, he must have run it through one of these programs that does, I forget what the word is for these things. But anyhow, 1-877-SOB-USOB. And if you dial that, you'll get the Capitol. And you can ask for the White House. You can ask for your senator. You can ask for your member of Congress. 1-877-SOB-U, as in the letter U, S-O-B. And that will get you through to Congress. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Greg in Richmond, Virginia on the line. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
By the way, I want to toss in before we go any farther, somebody pointed out in the chat room that Charles Wilson was it was in our government from 46 to 52. So that spanned Harry Truman and Eisenhower's administrations, as I recall. So anyhow, as you were saying.
Well, when you broke for commercial, I went ahead and flipped over to the guy that I used to listen to before I couldn't take it anymore and got Sirius Radio, so I could finally hear liberal talk here in Richmond, Virginia. And so I flipped over to Bill O'Reilly, and it was right in the middle of him talking about the whole the gay marriage thing that's going on in California. And he said that marriage is like driving a car. It's a privilege, not a right.
What?
And I was just interested to see what your opinion is on that.
Well, first of all, driving a car is a right. You have an absolute right to drive a car on your own property with no driver's license whatsoever. You can be 8 years old. You can drive a car on your own property. It's a right. However, to drive it on public, where other people share it, we have all agreed that we're going to limit that for our own safety. And so there it becomes a privilege. Marriage, however, there is no, to the best of my knowledge, there is nothing in the Constitution that says that we're excluding marriage from the rights that are granted to us. And the 9th and 10th Amendments of the Constitution are very clear that unless the Constitution takes away a right, you have it. I mean, the Bill of Rights doesn't give us rights. It says, and don't forget about these ones, by the way. So, I'd say somebody needs to get that guy a copy of the Constitution. That's really tragic. Greg, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Jeez, it's what can you say? And you thought you were voting against gays. I got a new one for you here today. 29 minutes past the hour for the conservatives listening. We'll be right back.
Party at Ed's house. Okay. Will Ed's parents be there? Then the answer is no.
Making sure an adult's there isn't easy.
No, his brother being there isn't the same.
But if you don't, your kid's more likely to do drugs.
No, I don't care if he is old for his age.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com.
Paid for by Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, Greg raises an interesting question. Actually, now that I've had 2.5 minutes to think about it, and also to discuss it with the folks in the chat room, interesting conversation about about, is marriage a right or a privilege? At the absolute, and to use the driving analogy, at the absolute point of rights in terms of private behavior, I suppose I was going to say that you have the right to marry your dog, which was Rick Santorum's whole thing. He said if you have gay marriage, next you're going to have bestiality. But when you want the state to recognize it and provide some legal protection for it and to force employers, for example, to recognize it for purposes of insurance and things like that, then I would be inclined to actually agree with old Crazy Bill there that it is a privilege. Now, then it becomes a question of, is this a privilege that we are going to grant to people? Or rather, let me rephrase that. At what point do we circumscribe this? I mean, there was a time, for example, in Europe in the Middle Ages, there was this thing called the right of the first knight. If a villager got married, the woman had to spend her first night sleeping with the local lord, the local feudal lord, or the local king, or the local prince. Now, the reason for this was so that there would be everybody in the community would end up related somehow to the prince. The first child would very often be the child of the local king. And it's really interesting, having lived in a little town in the middle of nowhere in Germany, and it's really, because this is right in the middle of the right of the first knight. I mean, for 800 years they did this, or probably much longer than that. And you go from town to town, and everybody looks the same. Everybody looks alike. Everybody in the one town has a big nose. Everybody in the next town has a particular type of hair. Everybody in the next town has a long neck, whatever. You know, there's distinguishing characteristics, and it's like they're all related. It's kind of strange. But anyhow, the legal right to marry was somewhat diminished and held by the local king. So then, you know, in the United States, we said, okay, for the first 100 years or so here in the United States, whites could get married, but blacks couldn't. In fact, they could be separated, and the woman could be sold at all in the slave states. So we didn't grant to African Americans. I mean, technically, at that point, they weren't even Americans. They were African slaves being held in America. We didn't grant to them rights of marriage. And then the laws were passed that said that it was illegal for whites to marry people of other races, and I believe this extended beyond Africans. I believe the laws against miscegenation, or however you pronounce it, extended even to Asians and things, although I may be wrong on that. Right up until the 1950s, when those laws were struck down. And so we have had a history in the United States of basically saying, okay, we're going to extend this right of marriage. And if it is true, as science has now demonstrated, that being gay is biological, that people are born this way. In fact, it seems to travel through the on one of the particular chromosomes, the X or Y chromosome, it seems to travel along the woman's side of the family, male gayness. You look at some of these very interesting epidemiological studies. Even if it was true that it was just a matter of choice, which is like what the conservatives say, which is nonsense, but regardless, one way or the other, you know, are we going to extend this right to gay people? In my opinion, this is a no-brainer. Of course, if people love each other and if they find themselves attracted to people of the same sex, what's wrong with that? I mean, we here in Vermont now, it's been what, 6 years we've had civil unions, and nothing has changed, other than we have a nice little tourism industry, I suppose, people coming in to get civil unionized. So, okay, we can say at some point, sure, it's a privilege, and it's a privilege. Are we going to discriminate against these folks or not? And I would guess that the cons are saying, yes, we're going to discriminate against them. And I would say, yeah, even, you know, that this is something that we don't want to be building more discrimination in the Constitution. It's just not the appropriate. We did that once. It was a horrible mistake. Both with slavery and with prohibition. Those are the two times that discrimination was built into the Constitution. And we've taken it out in both cases. The 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments were passed to take out slavery. And what was it? The 22nd Amendment was taken. I forget the number. To eliminate prohibition, it was right around there in the 20s. Yeah, we learn from our lessons. And folks in the red states, by the way, for the conservatives among us, and you thought you were, this is my what I said before the break, and you thought you were voting against gays and for Homeland Security. Hey, suckers. Article by Brody Mullins in today's Wall Street Journal about Congress's pro-business agenda. Republicans handed business two victories with progress on long-stalled class action and bankruptcy bills. These are two bills. No longer quoting from the Wall Street Journal here, now ranting myself. These are two bills that overtly help big business and overtly stick it to the average American. If you don't have the ability to, for a bunch of small people, a bunch of individual humans to band together into a class action to sue a large corporation, which is another bunch of humans who have banded together, stockholders, and cash that has banded together. If, in other words, if people can't organize to go against organized capital, which the Republicans took care of last month, they said, you can't do that anymore, no more class action lawsuits, at least not in state courts. We're going to kick them into the federal courts, where the federal judges are notoriously friendly to the corporations. End of that. And they're not answerable to anybody. In the state courts, you've got judges that at least have to look at the people in their communities. We're going to get rid of that. And now this bankruptcy disaster that increasingly, Rama sent me a note this morning. He says, you know, the more I look at this bankruptcy bill, the more it looks like it's not so much a screw the middle class as it is a screw the lower class, the people working on minimum wage, the very poorest among us. And I have to agree, the more I look at it, the more it's very clear. This is the worst kind of vicious class warfare here in the United States. But anyhow, the question that the Wall Street Journal asks is, will there, have the Republicans, shot their wad? Is this the end of it? Is it over? The calendar is the real enemy here, says former Democratic Senator J. Bennett Johnson of Louisiana, now an energy lobbyist, allied with the White House and the pending legislation. They have class action, bankruptcy, asbestos litigation, the energy bill, extending the dividends and capital gains tax cuts, permanent repeal of estate taxes, and medical malpractice. This is the list from today's Wall Street Journal. This is what the Republicans think they were voted into office to do. Every single one of these things, helping huge multinational corporations and screwing the average person. On Capitol Hill, Brody Mullins notes in this column, Republican lawmakers plainly share Mr. Bush's goal of making the U.S., quote, the best place in the world to do business, end quote. What does that mean? Republican senators are planning to hold a news conference within the next month with major U.S. business lobbies to unveil a category of priorities, including extensions of the capital gains and dividend tax cuts, permanent repeal of estate taxes, energy and asbestos litigation, an overhaul of medical malpractice laws, and reduced trade barriers with Central American and Caribbean nations. Mr. Bush's plan for private Social Security accounts also is viewed by some Wall Street interests as a potential boon for business. The Wall Street Journal would just say this stuff. I mean, it's just right up front about it. No need to hide it. Your thoughts on this? 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Chuck in Los Alamos. Hey, Chuck, thanks for sticking around. What's up?
No problem. It's great to hear you again. Any rate, I just wanted to I don't know if you heard this, but Bernie Evers just got convicted.
Yes, on all eight counts. They told me in the chat room.
It's fantastic. And, it's interesting. We have policy here. We got small business owners here in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to, well, basically our president and CEO makes exactly 3.5 times what the janitor makes.
That's remarkable.
And there's a socially responsible group here, and that's what we're trying to do. And I think it's great that Bernie got burned, because it's just criminal.
There's a huge non sequitur here, Chuck, and that is you've got these CEOs who are saying that they are worth, you know, $5 million, $10 million, $20 million, $50 million, $100 million a year in salary because they've got they know everything that's going on. They got their finger on the pulse of the thing. I don't know if you saw 60 Minutes where they interviewed Ken Lay on Sunday night. You know, it's like this guy's worth hundreds of millions of dollars because he's so wise and knowledgeable, a PhD in economics. And then they say, you were breaking. Oh, well, I knew nothing about that.
Well,
the Daffy Duck.
Our CEO and president's got a PhD. I'm the chairman. I've got a PhD. And I personally do not feel that I'm worth 100 times what the person who cleans the facility is. I can't even believe these people are so pathetically egotistical.
Yeah. It is rather mind-boggling. It is quite mind-boggling.
And thanks for sticking it out and being available to us in New Mexico again. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thanks for tuning us back in on KRSN. I'm glad to be back on the air in the Santa Fe, Los Alamos area there, Chuck.
Yep.
Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. David in Las Vegas, Nevada on the line. Hey, David, what's up?
An interesting point is, how is the United States going to react to federally recognized Canadian marriages between same-sex couples? That's a legal marriage.
Well, it's been in Holland. They've had legal marriages for half a decade or more. It's a good question. I don't know how we react to it, but... this is happening around the world. I don't know.
I know the Dutch do not recognize American marriages anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. So they've kind of reciprocally slapped us.
They've said, if you don't recognize all of our marriages, we're not recognizing yours, period.
Oh, that's tragic. That's amazing. Chuck, or David, rather, thanks for the call. I don't know the answer to the question, but I'm sure time will tell. We will find out. I mean, the bottom line here, you've got the Luddites, you got the pro-discrimination crowd, you got the bunch who probably in the 1950s they were saying no, don't let people of different races marry, and now in the 2000s they're saying no, don't let people of different sexual orientations marry or similar sexual orientations, different from the norm, and there'll always be something that they some way that they want to regulate us in our bedrooms and control our lives. It's just the nature of the conservative beast. Harriet in Seattle. Hey, Harriet, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. A couple of comments. One on the gay issue. All these ministers and what have you claim to be Christians talking about how every child should have a mother and a father. I have yet to hear them say anything about divorce.
Yeah, half of all children in America don't have both parents living at home.
Exactly. My other comment is, are you aware that in the divorce courts, when the people come out having been granted their divorce, they are greeted by credit card companies offering them a fresh start?
No, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's
and
pathetic.
This
They're
is well. See, this is
and these people are taking them up on it, and they start the whole cycle all over.
Yeah,
again.
And this is why one of the major subgroups. I mean, the largest group, of course, of people who are declaring bankruptcy are people who've been wiped out by medical expenses. That's more than half of them.
Right.
But one of the major remaining groups, a big chunk of the remaining half, or the little less than half, a big chunk of them are women, single women who have been divorced and who don't have the earning power that their husband had, or don't even have a job, and they're divorced, and very often they have the children, and they're not getting their child support payments, or even if they are, it's not enough to maintain the lifestyle that they had, or even half the lifestyle they had, and yet most families, when they split up, they may split up assets, but in a lot of families, they're also splitting up debt, and these women find that they just can't do it. They can't do it. They're drowning in debt that they inherited from their husbands, or it takes a while to make the transition from the lifestyle that they could sustain, living with, you know, two incomes to one of just one income, and they need to declare bankruptcy to get out from underneath it, and the Republicans come along and say, no, sorry, women, single women, you should never have divorced that awful, nasty guy you were married to. This is just blatantly anti-woman legislation. In my opinion,
it's basically what the credit card companies are doing is throwing these people a concrete life preserver.
Yeah, there you go. Well said. Harriet, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. It's always wonderful to hear from you. And thanks. And Harriet, in our chat room as well, if you want to say hi to her, go to TomHartmann.com and click on live chat. Philip in St. Louis, Missouri on the line. Hey, Philip, welcome to the program.
Hi. First, I want to say you need to get yourself on Sirius for more than an hour because I like listening to you talk.
Well, thanks for your kind comments, Philip. That's not up to me, and I don't discuss programming decisions about our affiliates. So,
and
they do carry the rest of the program. They just delay it later on in the day. But anyhow, let's move on to another topic. What's up?
You were talking about the marriage restrictions on black people. The laws actually restricted people from marrying outside their race because Mexicans could not marry black people either.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought it was every race had to stay within its own racial boundaries, as it were. Interesting. So, and how do you pronounce this word? Is it miscegenation? Do you know how to pronounce it?
You know, I sure don't.
Yeah, one of these days I'm going to find somebody who knows. It's one of those words that you read all your life, and I've never heard anybody say it out loud. So, or I have, and I haven't. It doesn't roll off my tongue. But anyhow, and it's against the law now in any case. But yeah. That's what they want to bring us back to.
I would agree with your statement earlier that if the Constitution doesn't specifically state that you don't have a right, that right exists.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the Ninth Amendment says. Right there. Any, it's either the 9th or the 10th. Is my recollection is, let me see here. I got it right here. The 9th Amendment, IV. The right of, no, that's the 4th, IV. XI. Here, I want IX. There you go. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Period. In other words, just because we say that there's some rights here, that doesn't mean that these are all the rights. Everything else you have. Philip, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where being progressive never felt so good.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Got to go back. We've got to go back. Got to go back. Got to go back.
Got to go back to democracy. Go back. Take a step back from these right-wing cranks that have taken over our government. Let's go back to some rationality in the United States. We've had one caller say it's miscegenation like United Nation, and another one say it's misogynation. So, you know, folks, and I tried to get the Merriam-Webster dictionary online, which normally will pronounce a word for you, and hook it up to the board here so I could actually play it for you, but it won't play on my computer. I don't know why. Jeff in Atlanta's on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, I was just thinking of a good analogy for people who say that homosexuality is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
If I said to you, here's a chocolate bowl of ice cream and a vanilla bowl of ice cream, which would you prefer? Well, you might say, I prefer chocolate, but, you know, I like vanilla too, but I prefer chocolate. Somebody said to me, here's a bowl of worms or a bowl of ice cream. It's not like I'd be thinking, which one would I prefer? You know?
Yeah.
It's not an option. It's like, yeah, I could eat the worms if I had to, but, you know.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question.
It's an imperfect analogy, but it's an interesting one. Go ahead, Jeff.
I know you have a spiritual background. When I see people who have a pro-Bush bumper sticker on the car, I give them the finger, and some people tell me that, you know, it's negative energy and stuff. But I just feel like it's my civic duty to somehow reflect to them, you are offending me.
Why not do it the other way around? I've got a bumper sticker upstairs. I haven't put it on my car. Somebody sent it to me. It says, Jesus, the original liberal. I think it's just great. You know,
Hey, speaking of that, did you read the poem I emailed you, if Jesus was alive today?
I don't recall, Jeff. I get a couple hundred emails a day, and
I also sent you my manuscript inside my tote bag for stoplittering.com. I don't know if you got that, if you're going
to
read it.
I'll have to take a look. Jeff, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Dana in Chicago on the line. Hey, whoops. Dana, you still there?
Hello. Yes, I am.
Hey, Dana, we've only got about a minute left. What's up?
The pronunciation is miscegenation.
Miscegenation.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The final Southern word.
Okay, and you are the final authority on it.
Indeed.
And the emphasis is on the first syllable.
Yes, miscegenation, like the English.
Yeah, okay, good.
Bye-bye.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Dana. Okay, we've got it. See, I'm telling you, I have the most well-informed, well-educated, articulate, thoughtful, insightful listeners in the entire world. So will the, just to wrap this up in the few seconds we have left, is the Bush administration and the Republican, quote, pro-business agenda, the one that nobody realized they were voting for, going to keep on a roll? Or is it toast? In my opinion, it's toast. I think we're seeing the worm turn, as it were, not to use Jeff's metaphor. But I think the change is beginning. People are starting to realize, hey, these guys said that they were in favor of morality and against terrorism, and really what they're in favor of is handing billions and trillions to their corporate buddies and to the very wealthy among us and hitting our kids with the debt. And we're not going to take it anymore. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, what do you think is the best city to do business in? Chicago? Boston? New York City? Los Angeles? Grand Rapids? Montpelier, Vermont? Portland, Oregon? Well, the Wall Street Journal weighs in on this today. An article by John W. Miller with the Dow Jones Newswires. Dateline Tallinn, Estonia. I've been to Estonia. In fact, Louise and I took a trip. We went up through Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia all the way up to Finland. You take a ferry across the, I forget which body of water it is there to get to Finland, but this was just right after the fall of the Soviet Union, as these countries were sort of coming out of it and coming out of their experience of being Soviet satellites. And now they are arriving very significantly. Okay, here's if you are a multinational corporation and you are looking for the best low-cost workforce for outsourcing call centers and other business support services. According to this article in today's Wall Street Journal, the source from Jones Lang LaSalle's Global Offshoring Index. Number one, New Delhi. Number two, Manila. Number three, Madras. Number four, Bangalore. Number five, Buenos Aires. Number six, Tianjin, China. Number seven, Sao Paulo. Number eight, Dalian, China. Number nine, Bangkok. And number 10, Shanghai. If, on the other hand, you're looking for the best workforce, number one, Manila, number two, Sao Paulo, number three, Mexico City, number four, Buenos Aires, number five, New Delhi, number six, Prague, number seven, Kuala Lumpur, number eight, Shanghai, number nine, Bangkok, number 10, Bangalore. I missed Los Angeles in there. Did you notice it? Or Topeka? Somehow, I don't think so. In 2004, notes John Miller in today's Wall Street Journal, Transcom decided that Eastern Europe could emulate India as a base for setting up call centers. It has since opened centers in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Hungary, bolstering a network of 42 centers in 23 mostly European countries. The idea, says Mr. Russell, is to market a combination of India-like cheap labor, strong skills in English and other European languages, and a sensitivity to Western culture. See, they're talking about these things in the newspaper in a way that 20 years ago would never have been discussed. Before Ronald Reagan came along, this would have been an unimaginable discussion. During the Eisenhower administration, even during Herbert Hoover's administration, even during McKinley's administration, let's just start tracking back the Republicans. During Ulysses S. Grant's administration, certainly during Abe Lincoln's administration. And then, of course, before that, the Democrats, going all the way back to Jefferson. The Federalists under John Adams. This would have been an unimaginable conversation. To what countries, to what cities in the world shall we encourage companies that do business in the United States, that make their profit from American consumers, to find their cheap labor so that they can maximize profits and throw more Americans out of work? Where shall we go? So far, though, Transcom's strategy seems to be working, notes the Wall Street Journal. It has attracted European businesses seeking a closer-to-home alternative to offshoring, with service offerings ranging from collecting credit card payments to booking travel tours. This is about how the Eastern European countries are now starting to compete with Western European countries for those kinds of jobs. And the cons love to run around and go, oh, you don't want to emulate the social safety net in France or Germany because, look, they're having unemployment problems. Why are they having unemployment problems? Because they're emulating our international trade policies. This is not rocket science, my friends. Founded in 1995, Transcom now has, see, this all goes back to the World Trade Organization, the European Union. A lot of folks, when the European Union was put together, a lot of folks in Europe. I mean, I was living there when this was being debated. This is going to be it's going to produce a lot of change, let's say. A lot of folks thought this is going to be a bad thing for the average worker in Europe, particularly if the Eastern European nations are let in. And originally the plan was we're going to take countries that have roughly the same standard of living. Spain and Portugal were like the lowest standard of living in the original European Union. And even at that, the British looked at this and said, no way, Charlie. We're going to keep the pound. We're going to maintain our own standard of living. Thank you very much. And now the EU is talking about letting in Turkey and Poland, and they've let in all these other countries, low wage countries. And what's happening? A great leveling. And we did the same thing in the United States when in 1947 we passed the Republican Congress, the Republican House, over the veto of Harry Truman, passed the Taft-Hartley Act, saying that Southern states that didn't want to have unions could say no. They could prevent workers from unionizing, and they did, and the South became a magnet for cheap labor. It was a big boom for the South for a while, and then the standard of living of the entire United States slowly started to settle in the early 80s as Reagan came along and said, well, you know, we've kicked the unions a little bit. 1947, when we passed the Taft-Hartley Act, 35% of the American workforce was unionized. When Reagan came into office, it was 25%. Let's get rid of the rest of them, said Reagan. And now we're down to 7.9% of the private workforce. Around 12 or 13% if you include government employees. And what has been the result? The loss of the American middle class. We are rapidly becoming a Dickensian nation, a Dickensian economy, the kind of economy that Charles Dickens wrote about, where you have a small number of extremely wealthy people and a large number of extremely poor people, and very little in between. Founded in 1995, Transcom now has a staff of 10,000. Its customers include FedEx Corp, International Business Machines Corp, otherwise known as IBM, and Royal Dutch Shell Group. Estonia, which joined the EU in May, has been a magnet for Transcom and other call centers, 54 in all, employing 1,700 people, partly because its residents speak a variety of languages because of a history of occupation. And the average monthly salary in Estonia is $606. That's not per week. That's per month. The average salary in Estonia works out to what? About $120 a week? Divide that by five. That's, about $25 a day? $23 a day? Something. Yeah, it's cheap. I can't do my math. If it's 5 into 120, you'd think you could figure that out. 5 into 100, of course, is 20. With a pool of, and then this other article by James Huque, recruiting trails increasingly take call center firms off the beaten path. With a pool of available skilled English-speaking workers in Manila, New Delhi, and Bangalore, India gradually dwindling because of strong demand, call center companies are casting their recruiting nets in areas thus far untouched by the outsourcing boom. They're talking about places like Davao, or maybe it's Davao. What is it? This is a little town in the middle of nowhere on an island in the Philippines. Well, it's not a little town. 1.4 million. In that part of the world, that's a little town, trust me. In Manila, call centers have created about 60,000 jobs in just a few years, so now they're moving into these The U.S. partner of 3G, Cyber City Teleservices Limited, opened Davao's first call center in October, creating more than 1,000 jobs for people to provide customer support for catalog companies, internet service providers, and other businesses. By the way, we had another couple of calls during the break telling us how to pronounce. This is the last one, said it's miscegenation, with the emphasis on gin. It's, I don't know. Now I know why I didn't know how to pronounce it, and I don't feel quite so embarrassed. Anyhow, what's going on? What's going on in America? Iran needed fuel. This is from David Ivanovich, the Houston Chronicle Washington Bureau. I just have to share this with you straight up. This is unbelievable. We know now that the Halliburton no-bid contracts were approved by the vice president's office. So we've seen the memos. We've seen the emails. This is clearly a violation of the United States law. In fact, it may be a felony. It may even rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors suitable for impeachment. But, of course, it will not be investigated because the Republicans control both the House and the Senate. And so any investigation would have to be filtered through the Republicans, and they're not going to do it. And Dick Cheney is still getting more money every year from Halliburton than he gets as vice president of the United States. And nobody thinks that's weird, although they were willing to spend $74 million to investigate the fact that Bill Clinton lost $34,000 on a land deal 30 years before he became president. You detect a double standard? So anyhow, David Ivanovich writes, Iraq needed fuel. Halliburton Company was ordered to get it there quick. So the Houston-based contractor charged the Pentagon $27.5 million to ship cooking and heating fuel. Now, guess how much it was worth? The heating, they charged you and me. You and I paid Halliburton $27.5 million to get heating and cooking fuel to the Iraqis. $82,100 worth of fuel. To ship $82,000 worth of fuel, Halliburton charged you and I $27.5 million. David Ivanovich notes, in the latest revelation about the company's oft-criticized performance in Iraq, a Pentagon audit report disclosed Monday showed Halliburton's subsidiary KBR spent $82,100 to buy liquefied petroleum gas, better known as LPG, in Kuwait. And then 335 times that number, that amount of money, to transport the fuel into violence-ridden Iraq. Pentagon auditors combing through the company's books were mystified by this charge.
We're just mystified. No, it's not criminal activity. It's just mystifying.
It is illogical that it would cost $27,514,833 to deliver $82,000 worth of LPG fuel. Officials in the Defense Contract Agency audit noted in the report. Henry Waxman and John Dingell would like to know what's going on. Waxman of California and Dingell of Michigan have released portions of this audit report, thus we know about it. We wouldn't know about it if it wasn't for for Dingell and Waxman. In a letter to President Bush Monday, Waxman and Dingell had complained the Pentagon officials had repeatedly ignored their requests to see copies of the Pentagon audit. Gee, I wonder why. Can you spell crime? 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What kind of fool do you take me for? You stole my heart and now you're back for more. Ain't no way you're coming through that door. What kind of fool do you take me for?
Well, actually, if you're talking about the Bush administration, here are the $226 million in the Homeland Security ad budget. Well, I'll tell you about that after this. First, let's go to Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, you're in Washington, D.C. today.
I'm in Washington, D.C. right this second in the Capitol building.
And what is happening in the belly of the beast?
Well, all kinds of things. It's been quite a busy day, and it isn't over yet. But one thing that I certainly attended earlier today was Congressman Tom DeLay's weekly pen and pad briefing for reporters, which he does as House Majority Leader. And it's always fascinating. It was particularly fascinating. For the listeners, what this basically means is that you can record it and you can make notes, but you can't broadcast it.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
So, So in theory, it's
so
a little
it's on the record, off the record.
Yeah, but everything is on the record.
Yeah.
So he spoke about a number of issues, including the budget, and talked about how Democrats were basically stopping everything.
But did he talk about how he might go to jail?
Well, before he went to questions, he said that he had a statement he wished to make. Hmm. It was amazing to watch everybody wake up.
Yeah.
Suddenly start scribbling when he said he was going to make a statement. And he is very angry with the Washington Post. He says that what they did over the weekend was so egregious. Basically, he said that what they printed over the weekend about him in terms of trips that he's taken and how they said it was funded and what they've said was simply not true. And he said they compounded that today with another follow-up article based on innuendo, not based on fact. Then he gave the facts, which I won't give here because it's lengthy, but it will no doubt be reported tomorrow. These are the facts according to him. He was furious. I mean, you know, he just was absolutely livid. Now, he also said he wants to work with the Ethics Committee. He's willing to meet with the chairman and the
Now that he's replaced two of the members of the Ethics Committee with people who get money from him, he's interested in working with them. That makes
sense. Exactly. But he's very keen to point out that the Democrats are closing down the Ethics Committee because they want power, not for any agenda, but because he says they want power for power's sake.
But the Democrats don't have a majority on the Ethics Committee. It's run by the Republicans. How can the Democrats do anything?
Well, he's basically saying that the Democrats are trying to close down and slow down everything everywhere.
But they have no power. They don't have a majority vote.
Democrats are demons.
Oh, I see.
You don't understand.
Yeah. This guy's been inhaling too much bug killer.
Well, it was fascinating. He went on like this, and it was, from a professional point of view, it was great stuff. So eventually he was asked after a while that, look, you chose this venue to make this statement. There are no TV cameras, so you've denied a third of America access to this information. Will you do this on camera? His reply, no. Next question.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, he wants to get the message out, but he doesn't want the discussion, you know, out. It's the old P.T. Barnum. I don't care what they say, so long as they spell my name right. To some extent, you know, he's getting any publicity is good publicity. But TV is so like an X-ray. You know, when he gets on TV, then he's got a problem. And I haven't seen, frankly, I haven't seen this story. You know, the Washington Post carried the story. I haven't seen it show up on TV. Have you?
No, I haven't seen it show up on TV.
I don't think the networks are going to get into this, and you know, until or unless something big happens, which won't happen by and large, in all probability, because the Democrats have no power on the committee, and because the House Ethics Committee now, he's replaced the two Republicans who are actually concerned with ethics with two guys from Texas who take money from him. So
fascinating.
Yeah, well, it's downright bizarre.
It really is. And I watched him carefully, and I watched him last week as well. I don't know this man. One impression I got was, you know, I was trying to think of something positive to say about him, because I can't say that I'm crazy about the man. The one thing that came across to me was that he is absolutely sincere.
Yeah. Or he makes a good, he presents himself as being absolutely sincere.
Well, and maybe you're right.
Which is the, I mean, Ted Bundy did that as well, who was, by the way, a registered Republican.
Oh!
Yeah. Sincerity, you know, the appearance of sincerity is one of the hallmarks of a sociopath, Victoria. Anyhow, thanks for sharing with us. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
We bang the drum slowly and play the fife lowly. You know the song in my heart. In the turning of twilight, in the shadows of moonlight, you can show me a new place to start.
How about starting with a new Congress? Let's sweep out the Republicans and say, enough! And let's get some Democrats with spine Let's get some greens in there, some progressives, or some Democrats who are willing to stand up to the multinational corporate interests who are saying, oh, we need all the cheap labor we can get, and if we can't import it into the United States, we'll export the jobs overseas. I mean, it's just very straightforward. And what about the folks? This is incredible. Here, we've got this juxtaposition of two stories. Today, in the Washington Post, article by Christopher Lee, the Bush administration rejects ruling on PR videos. A part of the government, the Government Accountability Office, has decided to reject what the Comptroller General, David M. Walker, said. David M. Walker said that these phony news stories, that this propaganda that the Bush administration has been cranking out to the tune of hundreds of billions or hundreds of millions of dollars, a quarter of $1 billion in press releases, that in phony news reports, a phony reporter and local radio station, local TV station, primarily television, local TV stations run these things, and people think, oh, the war on terrorism is really going well. Oh, the environment's really getting clean. Oh, gee, we're doing a great job with our efforts to help the American worker. Yeah, right. And then we find out that the Department of Homeland Security, they had their own little budget, which was also a quarter of $1 billion. Well, exactly $226 million, just a little under a quarter of $1 billion. And all the way back into May of 2002, this was 6 months after 9/11, or eight months, I guess it would be, after 9/11, they planned, they appropriated a quarter of $1 billion, $226 million, and planned to put together a whole bunch of ads telling Americans, okay, 9/11 has happened, there's terrorists out there, they want to get us, we need to band together, don't be crazy, we all need to be engaged, blah, 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 blah. And they put these things in the can, but then they didn't run them. They didn't run them. Until the weeks before we attacked Iraq. Isn't this fascinating? Here's a couple of the ads. It's Tom Ridge on TV. Quote, "To ultimately be the victor in the war against terrorism, we need all Americans to be engaged." The message of one of them. Here's the message of another. "Terrorism forces us to make a choice. We can be afraid or we can be ready." $226 million of your and my tax money spent to run these ads from the Department of Homeland Security on national television just before the start of the war in 2003 with Iraq. Just about this time, and this weekend is the second anniversary, 2 years ago, they concentrated them all right in that point in time to get people all hyped up and all pumped up, and Americans have to make a choice, and it's all about the war on terrorism. Pretty amazing. Now, also in the news today, you will recall, was it yesterday or Friday, that we reported that the Senate decided not to go along with Bush's so-called Clear Skies Initiative, which would have rolled back the rules that were put in place by the Clinton administration saying that power plants had to clean up their mercury emission. Now, the Clinton administration did it the old-fashioned way. They said, if you're going to burn coal and make electricity, you're going to have to put a scrubber on the top of that smokestack that sucks out the mercury. And industry said, but, you know, that's going to cost us some profits. And the Clinton administration said, tough. This year we had 600,000 children born with toxic levels of mercury in their bodies, suffering neurological damage, decreased IQ, an epidemic of autism happening in the United States. Tough. Costs you a little bit of profit. That's the cost of doing business. Of course, the power companies will pass it along to the ratepayers anyway, but, you know, they don't like that. So then George Bush comes along and says, well, let's do it this way. Let's just say that Those plants that pollute a lot, they have to pay a little bit of money to those plants that don't pollute as much. And those that don't pollute as much, they can get some money from those that do pollute a lot. And we'll just, you know, it'll be a shell game. And one company can own all the plants. So you can pay money to yourself. Well, this was the Clear Skies Initiative, and it would have reduced the amount of allowable mercury in the air about 6 or 8 years from now from the 5 million from the 5-ton target per year. By the way, a ton of mercury in the air is enough to damage about 800 million children. It would have reduced the amount of mercury from the 5-ton limit that the Bush administration was, or that the Clinton administration put into law. It would have so-called reduced it to 20 million tons. You can put 20 million tons in the air. Now, the current law says only 5. And so you can have 4 times as much mercury. But this is Clear Skies analysis. Well, in their wisdom, the Senate said, we're not going to go along with this. So Bush says, well, I'm going to do it anyway. I'll just change the rules. I don't need no stinking Senate. And here it is in the LA Times today. Market-based plan will cut output of the pollutant by almost 70% by 2018, the EPA says, in the first such effort by the federal government. Of course, that 70% by 2018 is the Bush target. 90% was the Clinton target. In other words, you know, it's just amazing to me how this is reported. Or unreported. This is not. Alan Miller and Tom Hamburger wrote this, Times staff writers. The lead sentence, the Bush administration plans today to unveil its long-awaited rule cutting mercury emissions from power plants, the first such step by the federal government. But the regulation already has drawn angry criticism from environmentalists, public health advocates, and lawmakers who say it fails to protect the public, especially young children. And they go on to note, an EPA analysis has found that about 600,000 babies born in the U.S. each year may be exposed to dangerous levels of mercury. And then they get to, well, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, where is it? It's all the way down toward the end of the story. You get to the, yeah, here it is. When you print this thing out, it runs 3 pages. And in the 4th paragraph from the end, in 2002, shortly before leaving office, the Clinton administration had concluded that mercury should be regulated as toxic under the Clean Air Act. This would have mandated curtailing emissions at every plant by the maximum amount possible, which proponents said could bring a 90% reduction in 3 years using existing technology. Talk about burying the lead. I mean, that's the law right now, is that within 3 years, we have to reduce it to 90% below what it is right now, a 90% reduction. So Bush comes along and he says, no, we're going to reduce it only to 70%, and we're going to not do that until 2018. And somehow, this is like the government is finally cutting mercury? I don't get it. I just don't get it. The Environmental Protection Agency says its target will be to cut emissions of the neurotoxin to 38 tons annually by 2010, a 21% reduction from 1999 levels, and to 15 tons by 2018, nearly a 70% reduction by 2018. Keep in mind, under the current law in place, put in place by Bill Clinton, within 3 years, it has to be down to 90% below, down to 5 tons. But the Bush is going to say today, no, we're going to do away with that Clinton rule. That was just too tough. A little mercury never hurt anybody. This weekend, by the way, March 18th through the 20th, is the 2-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. United for Peace and Justice, this notice, this coming weekend will mark 2 years since the U.S.-led bombing and invasion of Iraq began. No weapons of mass destruction were ever found. No compelling reason for the war was ever given. Yet more than 1,500 U.S. soldiers have been killed, more than 11,000 wounded, 100,000 Iraqis are dead. That's innocent Iraqis. That's in addition to the combatants. And the country remains gripped by horrifying violence with no end in sight. And then they note all over the United States and all around the world, people will be converging through the March 18 through 20 weekend to protest the war and occupation, mourn the losses, and demand immediate U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. More than 365 activities in at least 45 states are already listed on our calendar at www.unitedforpeace.org. So if you want to check it out, the March 18 through 20 weekend will feature an array of vibrant events ranging from marches and rallies to silent vigils, civil disobedience actions, interfaith services, musical and theater performance and art exhibits. Main streets, courthouse squares, highways, bridges, public parks, in front of military recruiting stations. They talk about some specific ones. Juneau, Alaska, Atlanta, Georgia, Wilmington, Delaware, Appleton, Wisconsin, Springfield, Missouri, Amarillo, Texas. There will be interfaith memorial services in Des Moines, Iowa, Chicago, New York, Portland. There's a whole bunch of this stuff. Check it out. UnitedForPeace.org. Ron in Missouri sends me a note. He says, we were talking yesterday, a trucker called in, and we started talking about Missouri, whether it was a right-to-work state. Somebody called and said it was. And Ron sends me a note. He says, Tom, please correct that caller who just said that Missouri is a right-to-work state. There was a big push way back in the late 70s to get right-to-work passed. It was fairly soundly rejected by the voters. Everybody agreed at the time that the issue was dead in the state for a very long time. I have not heard a word about it since. I've lived in Missouri since 71. And if there has ever been a right to work passed here, they sure did a great job of sneaking it past me, Ron. So we'll assume that since you live there, Ron, you have some good sense of it. Right to work has got to be one of the most phony eyes. It's like right to slave labor. Right to give up your rights to democracy in the workplace. Because what the so-called right to work legislation says is you can't have democracy in the workplace. You have a dictatorship in the workplace, and you have to put up with it. Sorry, no democracy in the workplace. You cannot have a union if your employer decides that you're not going to have a union, by and large. I mean, I'm super hyper oversimplifying, but that's really what it boils down to, and we've seen it all across the country. I said earlier that I believe that the Republicans are beginning to disintegrate. Because the real Republican agenda is being revealed. People thought in 2004 that they were voting to stop gay marriages and, you know, in the red states, to stop gay marriages and to protect us from terrorists, to stand tall in the world. And now what they're discovering is that they voted to end the ability of the average person to sue if they're harmed, to end the ability of the average person to declare bankruptcy if they go broke, to raise the cost of medical services, to increase the amount of mercury and pollution in our air, to increase the taxes on our children, these massive taxes on our children that are being levied by the Bush administration so that they can give so-called tax breaks to their wealthy buddies right now. And it gets worse. A moderate Republican, this from Alan Fram in the Associated Press article today, Republican fights cuts to Medicaid. Here's a Republican bucking his own party. This is Gordon Smith, Republican from Oregon. A moderate Republican is trying to strip all $14 billion in Medicaid cuts from the Senate's $2.56 trillion budget, testing the GOP-run Congress's appetite for trimming spending as President Bush has proposed. See, Bush, Medicaid is sort of the health care of last resort for the most poor administered through the states. And Bush says, what? They're poor? That's not our constituency. It's the haves and the have-mores. That's his base. In fact, if you want to study a little Orwellian doublespeak here, newspeak, consider what Judd Gregg, the Senate Budget Committee chairman, Republican of New Hampshire, told his colleagues Monday Now, this he's speaking about a vote that was proposed by another Republican, Senator Gordon Smith of Oregon. And good on you, Senator Smith, by the way. Judd Gregg is talking about a vote that will restore the cuts to Medicaid. And Judd Gregg says, and I quote, a vote to erase the proposed Medicaid savings would mean, quote, that individual doesn't have any interest in our children or our children's children. Anybody who votes to allow $14 billion in funding for Medicaid, health care for the poorest among us, doesn't have any interest in our children or our children's children. Now, clearly, I would say Judd Gregg is talking, when he says our, he's talking about millionaires and billionaires, the people, of course, he represents in the United States Senate. He being one of the Republican elite. It's tragic, isn't it? It's tragic. And it's the beginning of the great unraveling. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
You gave them the old razzle dazzle.
Oh,
you razzle,
yeah.
Dazzled them.
And it worked so well.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them the old hocus pocus. You misdirected them.
What a show.
With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
And welcome back.
If it were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yes, indeed. As George said. I recently paid off my credit card balance in full, writes Mike, a correspondent here, on a Chase Visa from Circuit City. The due date was March 4th. The payment was received by Chase on February 28th. Today I received a statement saying my new balance was $13.53. So he calls him up and he says, I paid off the balance in full. How come I owe you $13.53? And they said, oh, you had to pay interest on all that time before we received your payment. And he says, but I paid before the due date. And they said, well, we still calculate interest every day. And he's like, what, is this like a car loan? I'm supposed to call you up and find out what the payoff amount is every day? It changes? And they said, yep. He actually got a supervisor on the line who told him, you know, essentially the same thing, although the supervisor finally waived the charges. Apparently Mike was a little irate, shall we say. He says, I remember the story you told about meeting the banker on the airplane. How do these people live with themselves? The credit industry is now one of the biggest scams going. This practice is disgraceful. The corporate greed in this country makes me nauseous. Actually, Mike, you mean nauseated. Nauseous means sickening to look at. Nauseated means sick at the stomach. So just for those of you who are word freaks. He says, if you read this on the air, could you please offer advice to myself and other listeners concerning this matter? Is there a federal or state agency that I should contact about these tactics? Yes, it's called the United States Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. They are the ones who pass the laws that need to be passed to re-regulate and re-restrain these purveyors of corporate greed. And the telephone number, the toll-free number for Congress, if you'd like to reach them, 1-877-SOB-USOB. That's the phone number. It'll get you through to Congress, to any member of Congress. 1-877-SOB-USOB. I'm not kidding. It really does. 877-782-8762 or SOB-USOB. Give your member of Congress a call and say, I'm over it with the credit card companies. Put these dogs back in the cage. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 7 minutes past the hour. Are civil rights the best anti-terror defense? This a question asked. This is marvelous by the Christian Science Monitor. Article by Peter Ford and Lisa Abend, which in German means evening, as I recall. Abendessen, end of day. Anyway, it's a should never learn more than one language, I guess, if you're going to live in America. The challenge, said former Romanian Prime Minister Petre Roman, is Solomonic. Do we fight terrorism or protect liberties? And this, you know, to a large extent, this is the way that the Bush administration has framed this thing over and over and over again. They have said to us, if you want to fight terrorism, you're going to have to give up some liberties. Therefore, the Patriot Act. Even though the Patriot Act had been sitting on the shelf for many years before 9/11, it was a nice sales tool. I mean, not unlike 9/11 was used to sell the attack of Iraq, but which had been on the shelf since 98, arguably since 91. But they never had a good enough sales pitch for it. And so they used 9/11 as a sales pitch, and it seemed to work. And now they're using 9/11 as a sales pitch to eliminate our civil liberties, or many of them, to say, you know, now we have sneak and peek rights. We can break into your house and check out what's going on in your home without telling you, without serving you with a search warrant. You may never know. We can go to the bookstore or the library and we can say, what's this guy reading? And by the way, if you tell him we asked, you go to jail. I'm telling you, the founders, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, John Adams, George Washington, John Jay, these guys are rolling, Ben Franklin, they are rolling over in their graves. Abraham Lincoln, who presided over the shedding of so much blood, over 600,000 American lives, to hold this Union together. So that, as to paraphrase him at Gettysburg, so that this nation of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. Well, now it's of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. And from what I believe it was his second inaugural, he said, with malice towards none and charity for all. Now it's with tax cuts for the rich and, you know, good luck, Charlie, for the middle class and the working class of America. Tax cuts for the corporations, the millionaires and the billionaires among us. In any case, they have sold us this idea of fighting terrorism as being something that's antithetical, that's the opposite of protecting liberties. You can't have both, they say. You can't have liberty, you can't have human rights, and fight terrorism, because it's such a strong battle, you know, it's such a tough war. You can't have both. We've got to be able to have six concentration camps now down in Guantanamo Bay and hold people, that even American citizens. We've got to be able to hold American citizens without the right to see a lawyer. Forget about the Bill of Rights. You can't have that and fight terror at the same time. That's the attitude, the position that this administration has been taking loudly since 9/11. Arguably, it's the position that conservatives have been advocating since Joe McCarthy. Back then, they were trying to use the communist threat to justify shutting up people who said things that they didn't like. And so here this brilliant bit of thinking from Peter Ford and Lisa Abend, or Abend. The answer suggests many of the participants in a conference call to mark the first anniversary of the Madrid railway bombings. Now get this, listen very carefully. Is that only by protecting liberties can terrorism be fought effectively? Isn't that brilliant? When you are the nation that other people want to be like, then the world or people in the world will not support terrorism against you. The world will be united with you. And communities where terrorists might try to hide out, they'll turn them in. Terrorists in the United States, I mean, you know, look at how long it took them to get Tim McVeigh. Terrorists in the United States have a hard time finding refuge because, by and large, people in the United States don't hate the United States. We love the United States, by and large. And the extent to which we can hold our nation up as an example, as a beacon of liberty, as this is how you want your country to be, that's the extent to which we cut the floor out from under the terrorists in the world who would seek to harm us. But when we go backwards, we feed the terrorists. We don't fight them, we feed them. George W. Bush and his administration, and particularly Alberto Gonzalez and Donald Rumsfeld, with these policies of torture, are feeding terrorism, because the terrorists are saying, see, the Americans are just like us. They're worse than us, they're saying. Here we had the situation over this last weekend where this guy got away on, what was it, on Friday, I guess it was. The guy got away from the Atlanta, in the Atlanta Fulton County Jail. Got a gun from a deputy sheriff. Goes in, kills the judge, kills the court reporter. This is truly tragic. I used to run the court reporter for him on CompuServe. These are really good people. Killed them. Probably if the prosecutor had been in the court at the moment, would have killed her. And he ends up in this woman's apartment up in Gwinnett County, which is a half hour north of Atlanta. And she essentially gets him to turn himself in. And she gets him not to kill her. Now, here's a guy who, by pretty much any definition, is a terrorist. He's accused of rape and violence against his girlfriend. He has killed three or four people, or certainly tried to kill four people, killed at least three, or is charged with it, let's say. You know, if this was an official news story, you'd say alleged. But, I mean, we know what's going on here. This is not like a fake news story made up by the government like the, so many of the others. And how did she win him over? Did she threaten to tie him to a board and hold him in the bathtub until he felt that he was drowning? Did she try to waterboard him? No. Did she perform a mock execution where she tied him up and put a gun to his head and let the trigger click so he thought he was going to die? No. I mean, these are things that we've done in Guantanamo. These are things we've done in Afghanistan. These are things we've done in Iraq. These are approved by Gonzalez and Rumsfeld. And we wonder why we're not getting good information. No, what she did was she got him to like her. Talk to anybody who is familiar at any reasonable level of sophistication with interrogation methods, whether it's a member of the police department whether it's somebody who's involved in our foreign service, in our intelligence service, and they will tell you it's all about creating the Stockholm Syndrome. I forget the year. This was maybe 15 years ago. Whenever the year that Atlanta was holding its Olympics, we were living in Atlanta. And I was writing a series of novels, which are still to this day unpublished. I've written a lot of stuff that probably isn't worth publishing. In any case, I wrote three novels about a private detective. And I wanted to get more information about private detectives and police and the law and all that kind of stuff. And so there was this guy, very decent guy. There was this guy, DeWitt Wanamaker, who was a private detective in Georgia. He had a PI agency. And I followed him around for a couple of weeks, and he gave me a lot of insight into what it's like to be in a private detective. And the Olympics are coming to Atlanta, and Atlanta did not have enough police for the Olympics. And so they said, okay, we're going to let, for the first time in the 130-some-odd-year history of the Georgia Police Academy, which is where they train state police, that they were going to let private detectives go through the police academy and go through a course in executive protection and training, basically a short version of the How to Become a State Trooper course, so that these people could be licensed to provide security for the Olympics, because there weren't enough cops in the state. And so DeWitt calls me up and he says, how'd you like to go through the Georgia Police Academy? And I said, that sounds great. And I owned an advertising agency at the time. I could take a couple of weeks off from work. And so DeWitt and I together went through this program. And we learned hand-to-hand combat. I mean, there was a course in Aikido. We learned how to spin a car around without blowing a tire, how to avoid curbs and things. We learned, it was all sorts of weird stuff. And one of the things that we learned, and this is no secret, this is common sense. One of the things that we learned is that if you want to get information from people, the first thing you have to do is make them like you. Now, you may have to scare them too, but ideally, you don't do that. You have someone else scare them. We've known this forever. It's called the Mutt and Jeff routine, the good cop, bad cop routine. Well, somehow we forgot all about the good cops. We just became the bad cops. And here, Kofi Annan is reminding us of this. Upholding human rights is not merely compatible with a successful counterterrorism strategy. It is an essential element in it, says Kofi Annan. Compromising human rights facilitates achievement of the terrorist objective by ceding to him the high moral ground and provoking tension, hatred, and mistrust of government among precisely those parts of the population where he is most likely to find recruits. If you want to win the war on terror, return civil liberties to Americans, return America to a pluralistic society. Mr. President, allow protesters to show up at your staged meetings instead of dragging them off and arresting them. Let the rest of the world see a real democracy working rather than an oligarchic plutocracy and a kleptocracy. Let's get rid of this crony capitalism and go back to the ideals of people like Dwight Eisenhower and have a decent democracy in the United States. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
My daddy was a feather in the basement. Your mom was an engineer. And I was born one dark gray morning. Music coming in my ears, in my ears.
And welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Looks like our chat room just croaked. Just for those of you who got dumped out of it. Maybe it's coming back. I don't know. Let me see here. Doesn't seem to be there for me. So, anyhow, check it out. TomHartman.com, live chat. Maybe it's working. Maybe it's not. I think they had a server failure. Yeah. Oh, actually, I'm back in there now. So, apparently, it's coming back. Anyhow, what's the best way to fight the war on terrorism? Is it by being bullies and by running around the world, you're either with us or you're against us, you're either with the terror, or is it by being the country that everybody wants to emulate, the country that everybody wants to come to, a wonderful place to live and work, a country that has a strong and vibrant middle class, a country that has good health care, a country that has a good educational system, a country that is the country that people want to say, you know, I share the values of those people and of that nation. How do you fight terrorism? Alice in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom, I was very happy to hear you talking about peace marches. We are expecting a big turnout here in Eureka, California, Saturday, March the 19th.
That's marvelous.
Tom Seaborn on KGOE has been putting in plugs for it.
That's great. Where and when will it be, Alice, in Eureka?
Well, I think they'll give that. I'm sorry.
But
I've heard it. But
yeah, okay. So they're
not. I didn't retain it.
That's okay. So they're announcing it on your local station. That's great. Okay.
They'll tell what place and.
Well, great, Alice. Thank you. Thank you for the reminder.
Oh well, keep up the good work.
I'll do my very best, and you too, Alice. Thanks so much for calling.
Bye.
Bye now. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, by the way. If you'd like to call in and voice your thoughts on this or any other issue of the day. Tim in Illinois on the line. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the Viagra for the brain.
There you go. What's up?
Well, I spoke today with the managing editor of the Burlington Free Press about the Clear Skies story, and he acknowledged it gave the wrong impression, but he defended the lead and declined to run a correction because the lead was technically correct.
Well,
now,
this is...
you know, and we had a long discussion, and basically that is just totally bogus and it's unprofessional.
Yeah.
It's like saying the Nazis had a law in place that allows 100 Jews to be killed per day, but then Hitler proposed a new rule to limit Jew murders to 150 per day.
Right.
And if the proposal gets shot down, you could technically say someone was against the proposal to limit murders.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't use quite as inflammatory, but yeah.
Well, that's a lesson from the 60s.
Yeah.
Exaggerate to make a point.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you about that, but using the Holocaust usually, that is such a hot thing that you know, people disconnect. But when you start talking about that, it's one of the reasons why although I will discuss parallels between Hitler and Bush and the rise thereof of each, I'm always very careful to point out that there are huge differences between the two. Hitler was a war hero. He was actually wounded in battle. I need not point out the rest of the differences. In any case, yeah, yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter what name you want to put in there or what particular example. The thing that bothered me is that the managing editor of this newspaper was defending an unprofessional practice.
Yeah. Well, you know, I shared with you a story in the first hour, I believe, of the program, or perhaps the second hour, which was essentially saying the same thing. I mean, this is from the Los Angeles Times. It's continuing. I mean, it's just papers all across the United States. And I have a feeling that what they're doing is they're reprinting government news releases. I'll bet you anything that there are news releases coming out of EPA, which has now become politicized, which are saying, President Bush is going to blah, blah, you know, like this. President Bush is now going to cut mercury emissions. Well, you know, except that Clinton already cut them more, and Bush is undoing that and cutting them less. But that's not what the news release in the EPA says, and so that's how it gets reported. I don't think that these reporters, Tim, are, you know, part of some stupid conspiracy or part of some conservative conspiracy, although you've got the corporate agenda of the newspapers they're in. I have a feeling that this is part of this larger thing of this $250 million effort on the part of the Bush administration to give us our news, to manage the news.
I agree with that.
Anyhow, Tim, thanks for staying on the story. I'm really impressed that you would call my hometown newspaper, which I should be doing too. I appreciate it. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There is no doubt we're running out of our petroleum. In 30 years it disappears, and that is worrisome. So we send the fleet but drag our feet on renewable energy. 'Cause God forbid our friends in Texas lose their monopoly. Though solar power would not pollute our water, air, and soil.
Well, you get the idea. Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. The counterproductive use of torture. This is from the Center for American Progress today, even to set aside the ideological case against outsourcing torture, this rendition, right? This is where the Justice Department, the White House, they want to send people now in our custody off to countries where we know they will be tortured. In fact, in some cases, explicitly for them to be tortured. The CIA is now carrying out these rendition expeditions so frequently that relatively amateur aviation enthusiasts have begun to document the trips. They're keeping track of the airplanes. Okay. So even to set aside the ideological case against outsourcing torture, writes the Center for American Progress today, the Bush administration carrying out of the rendition program has been seriously flawed. First, torture is usually counterproductive. Veteran agents of both the FBI and CIA, quote, doubt the effectiveness of physical coercion as a means of extracting reliable information, end quote, as a prisoner subjected to intense physical pain will admit just about anything to end the torture. Intelligence agents then end up chasing down false confessions instead of devoting time to real leads. A glaring example of this is that the Bush administration's pre-Iraq invasion claims of a connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda came from a prisoner who had been rendered to Egypt, tortured, and later recanted the same information he had provided. This is absolutely mind-boggling. The Bushies, I mean, what are we, going back to the Middle Ages? Getting out the thumb screws? Someday are they going to, you know, you go over to England right now, and you can take tours of the castles. And some of them still have the torture chambers intact, and you can see the old Iron Maidens and the thumb screws and some of the weirder things that they use to torture people. When our children are our age, will they be going to the museum of the five U.S. concentration camps in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and looking at the torture devices and the torture cells, and here's the tub in which they did the waterboarding, and here's the wall where they did the phony firing squads, and here's the cell where the people were shackled to the floor in their own excrement. Here are the electric the tasers that were used on. This is not the America that I thought I grew up in. I thought I grew up in a decent country. Well, I did. I grew up in a decent country that loves liberty and loves freedom. And right now we have this aberrant little moment in history where a group of people, of right-wing extremists, have taken over the House, the Senate, the White House, and the Supreme Court. And they do not represent the majority of Americans. They do not represent the interests of the majority of Americans. They don't even represent the viewpoints of the majority of Americans. The majority of Americans would like to have bankruptcy protection if they get wiped out because of medical bills. For that matter, the majority of Americans would like to not have to worry about medical bills, would like to have national health insurance like every other industrialized nation in the world. This is incredible. Imagine a conversation, writes Craig Crawford. How did we fall for this? Well, here's where it happens. Imagine a conversation, writes Craig Crawford, a columnist for CQ.com, where one person does all the talking, except for a few laudatory comments from well-wishers, while those who speak up in disagreement are forcibly removed from sight before anyone can hear what they say. Would you call that a conversation? I don't think I would. But that's what the White House is calling, notes Crawford, a conversation on strengthening Social Security. When the president appears in Middle America, as he did on March 10th in Craig's hometown, to promote his ideas for changing the nation's 70-year-old retirement system, it's more like a conversation with himself. These orchestrated events before crowds of mostly handpicked supporters serve the purpose of helping George W. Bush get his message out directly. This is a columnist in Louisville. He says, one of the so-called protesters, Craig Crawford, one of the so-called protesters at the Louisville appearance says he just wanted to know if the president would consider a creditable alternative to create private savings accounts for future Social Security beneficiaries. Mike Bailey is the guy. He wasn't arguing with the president, with Bush. He wasn't calling him a liar or pointing out that he was lying. He simply wanted to ask a reasonable question. Bailey stands up and says, "How about private accounts outside Social Security?" Bush, now back to the column here. Bush talked over Bailey in a quickly improvised reference to Kentucky's strong economy. The gratuitous mention of their home state prompted a vocal reaction from the audience, eager to help the president muzzle dissent. During the ensuing standing ovation, police quickly hauled Bailey out of the theater. "He wasn't listening," Bailey said. "He's good at that." Retired Louisville school teacher James McMillan. Boy, he had two people willing to stand up to him. Voiced another dissenting and most unheard view during Bush's Kentucky appearance. McMillan said he wanted the president to address concerns that his changes to Social Security could scuttle its finances, putting it in more jeopardy. Another, just an honest question. But he too was drowned out by the president and his applauding crowd, then whisked away by security forces before being heard. Both men, notes this report, this reporter, Craig Crawford, both men maintain in CQ.com, both men maintain that they did not go to this event planning to interrupt the president. Neither gave the appearance of being professional protesters. Each said they had never done anything like this, but grew frustrated as they realized that Bush was not going to invite any tough questions. Bailey said he just wasn't giving the whole story. It came into my mind while he was talking. I had to say something. Don't you think? I mean, let's just be honest here. Democrats, Republicans, Americans. Wouldn't we all be better off? And wouldn't we all think that our nation would be stronger? Wouldn't the Bush administration even be stronger if George Bush honestly answered honest questions? If there was real dialogue? The way it used to be? You know, Bill Clinton used to have town meetings. He'd go around, he'd talk to people. The tradition of Thomas Jefferson used to answer the door of the White House himself. In fact, very often people would come to visit him at the White House. They'd knock on the door, he'd open the door, and they'd think he was the butler. I guarantee you that's not going to happen in George W. Bush's White House, and you can understand the security aspects of that, but how about at least having a reasonable conversation with the American people instead of just putting out the talking points and the fake news? Mr. President, we're tired of fake news. We'd like to hear the straight story. Just once in a while. Actually, we'd like to hear it all the time. But, I mean, even once in a while would be refreshing. Instead of the spin. Here we have, now this is the same thing. I mean, this is Tom Ridge when he was head of the Homeland Security Department. Now, each was having a little problem with his inspector general. Now, you see, the inspector general's offices were created back after Watergate. Basically what Congress said was that each of the cabinet level branches of government should have somebody within it who is independent of it, who can you know, look over things and make sure that everything's on the up and up. Just, you know, it's a very straightforward thing. The Senate actually, you know, nominates the IG, as I recall. Well, here is the Associated Press. Pete Yost writes in the Associated Press, "Congress created the federal system of inspectors general in response to the Watergate scandal. The intent was to free these officials from political pressure so they could aggressively oversee cabinet agencies' programs. So the inspector general for the Homeland Security Department was a guy by the name of Clark Kent Irving. Nice looking guy. His picture's here in the paper. He looks like he's in his maybe late 30s, you know, decent guy. And what happened? Well, Pete Yost tells us about it in this Associated Press article. Twice, Tom Ridge drags this guy into his office and says, "Why are you writing reports critical of me and the Homeland Security Department? We're all supposed to be saying everything's fine, be happy. We're supposed to be telling the American people there's nothing to worry about. We're doing a great job here. Re-elect Bush." And Irvin says, "I wrote the reports that were critical of the agency because that's my job. If there's something, if you're doing something wrong, if there's something not being done right, I am supposed to point it out. That's my job." Here, Pete Yost in the Associated Press. The Homeland Security Department's former independent watchdog says he was twice summoned to then-Secretary Tom Ridge's office last year and asked why his reports criticizing the agency were being sent to Congress. Well, that's because he works for Congress, see? And whether they could be presented more favorably to the department. During a June 9th meeting, this is Clark Irving, the Inspector General. We're quoting him now. Pete Yost quoting him in the AP. "Ridge said a couple of times, 'Look, are you my IG?' And I said, 'No, I am not your IG,' Irvin recalled. Irvin said that when he told Ridge that the Inspector General served the public, the former Pennsylvania governor replied, quote, 'I had an IG in Pennsylvania, and he didn't release things to the legislature or to the press.' Irvin said he answered, 'But I do here. I have a reporting obligation to Congress.' Irving said the meeting was 2 hours of, and we're quoting Irving now, meeting was 2 hours of, 'Why are you doing this? Why are you being negative to the department? Why are you releasing reports?' It was a long come to Jesus meeting, angry and confrontational. I just spent the whole time trying to educate him about the role of the Inspector General." The Bush administration, by the way, chose not to reappoint Mr. Irving, whose job expired at the end of December. In a subsequent meeting, 5 weeks before the November 2nd election, Irving said, "Ridge talked about presenting the Inspector General's reports in a way that would make them seem less critical of the department." This is from Pete Yost's AP story. According to Irving, Ridge asked, quote, "What can we do to coordinate our message on these reports so that you and we are saying the same thing about it?" Irving recalled, "I said, quote, 'I'm not in the spin business. We don't coordinate our messages with the department. You can characterize it and spin it however you want. That's your business, but it's not ours, and we're not going to coordinate anything with you.'" Tom Ridge apparently is going, "Wait a minute. We are in the spin business. Whenever bad news happens, we run out and we have we got to raise the terror alert. Maybe we found Osama. Maybe we didn't. Hey, there's another guy. We found a terrorist here in Pakistan. Well, it was 3 weeks ago, but today is a bad news day, so we're..." This White House has elevated the spin business to an art form, and here's this guy who says, "I'm not going to go along with it. I'm not going to participate in it." And Tom Ridge is just going nuts. Absolutely going nuts. Finally, Ridge says, "Why do you guys have to share your reports with Congress?" I mean, do you get this? How strange this is. Here's a cabinet-level official. His job is to be accountable to... He works for you and me, for we the people, Tom Ridge. His job is to protect us. And Congress has discovered, after the Watergate scandal, they discovered that sometimes in the executive branch, the president and all the president's men and women... That sometimes in the executive branch, people are not all that interested in simply serving we the people. They would rather make sure that the political agenda is advanced. They'd rather serve the president. They'd rather say, "Okay, we're going to do the things that are going to make the administration look good. It doesn't matter, you know, whether it's true or not. It doesn't. We're going to time these things. We're going to, you know, the news cycle, the spin machine, all this stuff. And, you know, go along with the talking points that come down from from Roger Ailes at Faux News, and what does the Heritage Foundation have to say today, and what are the words that we should use? What are the magic words that, Frank Luntz tells us that we should use or we shouldn't use? And why can't we all be on the same page? And let's have these meetings. Let's get together with Grover Norquist and find out, you know, how do we need to manage this stuff so that GE, one of the world's largest defense contractors, can be sure that their news departments at NBC, where you've got Brian Williams now reporting the news, who says that he feels that it's part of his job responsibility to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day, so that Brian Williams can be sure to report the news right. And this guy comes along and says, well, I'm the Inspector General. It's my job to report to Congress on how you guys are doing. And Tom Ridge says, why do you guys have to share your reports with Congress? Irving said he explained that he had a dual responsibility under the law to send his reports both to Ridge and to the Hill. And boy, did they get rid of him fast. I'm telling you, it's the Soviet Union all over again. It is scary. 10 minutes before the hour. And then bought another TV station, then bought a radio network, and then bought a newspaper, and then bought another newspaper, and then bought another TV network. And pretty soon he owned all the radio and TV networks in Italy and the major newspapers. The only network he didn't control was the state-run television, their equivalent of public broadcasting. And then he decided to run for office. And guess what? Controlling all the media in Italy, as he ran for office, Silvio Berlusconi won. Yes, indeed, all by himself. Well, now Mr. Berlusconi, old Solo Mio, the one guy, the strongman, the Italian strongman, he is now saying to the United States, you can be O Solo Mio. Yeah. You're on your own, guys, he's saying. Here's this just out. Just this morning, Silvio Berlusconi has announced that Italy will begin withdrawing its 3,000 troops from Iraq. He's taking them out. He's pulling them out. It's going to be just us. Well, not just us. But this is the fourth largest contingent. They have 3,000 troops. The fourth largest contingent in Iraq. It's going to be U.S., Britain, South Korea, and the private armies, of course. And I tell you, this is more tragedy, more difficulty for our troops, more because of this insane, misguided, lied us into it policy, the Bush administration. And even Berlusconi figuring it out. He's saying, sorry, guys, you're going to have to go it alone. You're on your own. This, of course, is a result of the shooting of one of the top security agents, one of the top intelligence agents in all of Italy by U.S. forces. And the Italians suggesting that they were a little trigger-happy, and then it turned out that this was not even a U.S. Army checkpoint, and it hadn't been sped through. It was actually John, who me torture, who me lead the Contras, who me overthrow government. It was John Negroponte's private security detail that shot up this car, and the Italians are none too happy about it. So Berlusconi says, I've spoken with Tony Blair about this, and it's the public opinion of our countries that expects this decision. They're going to start withdrawing in September. Your Berlusconi alert for the day. And that wraps up our program. Thanks so much for being with us today. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Do good. Get active. Don't forget the number for Congress, 877-SOB-USOB.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.